Someone was once asked, who is the greatest preacher that ever lived? It's maybe not something that you think about very often. Some of you may have wondered it. Is it John Calvin? Is it Charles Spurgeon? He was a pastor in London. Calvin pastored in Geneva, Switzerland, for many years. Spurgeon was in London, and he had 6,000 people every service. They had a couple services. What about Jonathan Edwards? He was a New England preacher. He was in Northampton, Massachusetts. Didn't have a huge congregation, but God used him greatly in the Great Awakening. Or what about George Whitefield? Have you ever heard of him? Preached out in the open air to sometimes thousands of people at a time. They didn't have microphones back then. And it's said that he's preached perhaps up to 80,000 sermons. He would preach 8 times a week sometimes, or more. Well, just a few weeks ago, we were down in Massachusetts visiting Karen's family, and her sister and husband are friends with the pastor, who is now the pastor at Old South Presbyterian Church, which is the church where George Whitefield is buried under the pulpit. And so they arranged a tour for me with this pastor. And we went over, Anna actually went with me. We got to go up into the steeple where Paul Revere was Revere and Sons cast the bell up there in their tower. And when we were walking up these rickety stairs, you felt like you were just going back in time into the 1700s. Just the smell of the old wood and these huge beams. I'm amazed how big the trees must have been to make these beams longer than it is even in here. And thinking about George Whitefield, he actually died in Newburyport, Mass., right down the street from this church. He was supposed to preach there on Sunday, but he never was able to. He died a few days before that. And he's now buried under the pulpit, which is a little bit strange. We went down in the basement, and you can see the tomb where he's buried with 2 other pastors as well. And there's a guest book there that shows people who came to hear him preach back in the, I believe he died in 1770. So there were no cars back then. And people would come as far, I think there are some people who signed the guest book from Wisconsin. I know from the Midwest. And it would take them 2 weeks to travel by horse and buggy to get from there all the way to Massachusetts to hear Whitefield. So we come back to the question, well, who is the greatest preacher? We can talk about all these people who gathered large crowds, but the person who answered this question, I'll never forget what they said. They said, the greatest preacher who ever lived is probably somewhere in a little jungle village that you've never heard of. It's probably someone you've never heard of, preaching to people somewhere in the world. And I thought, what? That doesn't make sense. But then we have to think, whose eyes, in whose eyes is greatness declared? Because if we look in our own eyes, we think about big churches, right? Or lots of people who are drawn to hear. We think often in human perspectives. If they're popular, then they must be important. They must be great. If they're noticed, if they're famous, if they're strong, or if a place is innovative, think about St. Albans. What do we have to boast of for this place? We're intrigued with people who are celebrities. It's in the news all the time of what this person's doing and what this person's doing and what they're not doing and who they're hanging out with. We have a fascination with that. Is that greatness? Karen's parents came up this last week and they picked up one of those brochures as they're traveling. It must have been at a rest area. And you can see all the different exits of Vermont are listed in there. And in each exit, they talk about what's worth seeing. So you get off the exit and this is what you can see. And so I flipped to St. Albans, and I thought, well, what do they say about St. Albans? You know, what's worth seeing in St. Albans? And they talked about strolling around in Taylor Park and different things like that. They were talking about events happening in the winter. I think they mentioned Collins Purley with the ice skating rink, things like that. And I just started thinking about, in order to be noticed or to be great, we have to say something important, don't we, about ourselves or about our place. What do we have in St. Oh, well, we have a Ben and Jerry's factory right down here. Come see that. Or we have immigration and naturalization. Well, that's not very attractive, is it? Usually. And we get wrapped up into a what we could call small syndrome. We're too small to really matter. We're too small to make a difference. We're not very important in the world's eyes. Sometimes you feel this. Sometimes we feel it about where we live, the place. Sometimes we feel it about people, ourselves. But look at Bethlehem. Bethlehem was too small to be noticed. It was a small city. Actually, its older name was Ephrathah, which we might not be familiar with. It was located in the land of Judah, which was the southern part. Remember, after the kingdom split, there was Israel in the north, Judah in the south. So it was within Judah. It was about 5 miles away from one of the most important, to many people, cities of Judah, Jerusalem. 5 miles south of Jerusalem. So you can think of St. Albans as, what, 25 miles north of Burlington. So here, Bethlehem is even overshadowed even more by this big city of Jerusalem. And it was so small that it was left off the list of cities in Judah. The Bible talks about in Joshua chapter 15, it was listing all the cities in Judah. And they didn't even mention Bethlehem because it was so tiny. Micah, earlier in this book, he is mentioning the fortified cities, or the cities of defense in Judah, and he does not mention Bethlehem. It's not big enough. The sense that we get, as a commentator said, is that Bethlehem is weak and despised. That they can't really measure up to in military strength, in military terms. And if you think about it, the kings lived in Jerusalem. Kings were born in Jerusalem. You know, when you have anyone who's speaking or who's written a book, you turn to the back of the book and you see, what are the credentials of this person? Where did they grow up? Where did they go to college? Where did they go to high school? Where did they get their PhD? Where have they worked? And all of these things start to matter. Well, Bethlehem would not have had very many credentials, although it wasn't without significance. Rachel was buried there. Remember Rachel and Leah, wife of Jacob? Rachel was buried there. She actually died giving birth to Benjamin, her last son, in the Bethlehem area. Remember Ruth and Naomi? Naomi was from Bethlehem. And Ruth and Naomi went back to Bethlehem. Ruth found this man Boaz, right? And they got married and they had a child named Obed. And Obed was the father of Jesse, who was the father of David. So David, King David, was actually born in Bethlehem. He was not born in Jerusalem. So this was significant. But oftentimes we think about Bethlehem and it's little, it's not significant to be noticed. When I was in college, actually, it was, Jason will appreciate this, when I was out at Calvin College, Vermont's a long way from Calvin College. And someone was asking me where I was from. I said, well, I'm from Vermont. They looked at me with all earnestness and said, well, what state is that in? And I didn't quite know how to answer them. Because at first I thought, well, maybe they're just joking. And then I saw they weren't joking. We had a visitor here a few years ago And he had attended a PCA church, I believe, down in Virginia, and his pastor kept telling him, well, there are no PCA churches in Vermont. The PCA isn't in Vermont. And so he had to come and visit here to see if that was true or not. And we explained, well, yep, there is one church. We're small, but we are here, but not enough to be even noticed in our own denomination. But I want to tell you this morning that God uses the small and insignificant things for His glory. And that is something that can encourage us this morning, because we see it here. We see what He does with Bethlehem. We see this throughout the whole Bible, actually. And I'm just going to mention a few things to encourage you here. Remember Gideon? Gideon was just some man. He appears in Judges chapter 6, and Midian, this country, is oppressing the people of Israel, and God raises up Gideon. And do you know what Gideon says to the Lord? God says, Gideon, I want you to lead my people. You know what he says to the Lord? He says, please, Lord, how can I save Israel? Behold, my clan is the weakest in Manasseh, and I am the least in my father's house. So there we have the weakest and the least. And I can picture God saying, that's right. That sounds about right. He tells Gideon right after that, but I will be with you. And then 32,000 people came to Gideon. Remember what Gideon did? God told him, go down and tear down the altar to Baal. And so Gideon's so afraid to do this in daylight that he goes at night. He takes 10 men with him. He goes at night, and they take a bull, and they probably tied a rope around him and pulled down the altar. And when the people woke up the next morning, they saw that this was done, and they said, who did this? And that's actually Gideon's father who defends him. Gideon did this. And if you have a problem, then you deal with the Lord with it. And because of that, 32,000 people came to Gideon as the leader. But God said, no, it's too many. Too many people. Anyone who's afraid can leave right now. You know how many people left? 22,000 left. So there's 10,000 people there who are going to go fight this battle. And God says, there's still too many. Still too many people. Have the people go down and drink at the brook. Get a drink. And the people that drink with their hands, that scoop the water up with their hands and drink it like this, those are the people that I want to fight for me. You know how many people just knelt down, maybe had their hands behind their back, and drank right out of the brook, not using their hands? 9,700. So there's 300 people left. And God says, okay, that's good. That's enough for me to use now. God uses the small and the weak things to show His glory. Here's another story. Ruth, you know Ruth. We've talked about her recently. There is no king in Israel. Everybody's doing what is right in their own eyes. And Ruth, who is she? She's a foreigner and she's a widow. She went to Bethlehem, and then from her, David, King David, was born. Let's talk about David for a minute. How many brothers and sisters did David have? He had 7 brothers. So there are 8 kids, as we know. We're not sure if there are any sisters or not. But Saul came to anoint a king in Israel. He knew that the king would come from Jesse's house. Well, Jesse was just this castaway shepherd man. His family, they were shepherders. But Saul came to him and he says, bring your sons before me. And the big, strong, tall sons came forward, and Samuel's like, nope, not him. Nope, not him. Went through all 7 and said, do you have any more sons? Well, yeah, there's one more, but he's out in the field tending the sheep. Well, bring him in. So David came in and Samuel said, he is the one. And guess what? He was the youngest. And he was the smallest. And he was the one who fought Goliath, wasn't he? God uses the small and insignificant for his glory. Why does God do this? Why does he use the small and insignificant? Three things this morning. The first thing is to expose our error and to humble us. To expose our error and humble us. Because you know what we do? We wrongly hope in ourselves. We wrongly think if we can become great, if we can show our greatness and our strength, then we will do great things for God. Which could be true, but yet God usually works in other ways. Sometimes we put our hope in our country. We put our hope in how big our military is. That's what was happening here in Micah. Remember in Isaiah, the time of Ahab, King Ahab, he was saying, trust in the Lord. Isaiah was saying to Ahab, trust in the Lord. And Ahab said, I'm not going to trust in the Lord. Basically, he said, I'm going to trust in my armies. And he went after and he made this big military alliance, which was a failure. Micah prophesied during the same time as Isaiah to the same people in Judah. And he's saying the same types of things. But these people are trusting in their military. They're trusting in their own wisdom, their own intelligence, their own ingenuity. And really the context here is judgment. You have left the Lord. You're not trusting in the Lord anymore. You're just doing what you think is right. One commentator says there's moral rot in the land. Moral rot. There's a lot of wealth and poverty here. And we know that sometimes when there's lots of wealth and poverty, we think that we're fine, that we're not in need. But yet, what was happening there is the wealthy were actually attacking the poor people. And not attacking them physically, but they were doing injustice to them. There was this elite, rich group, and they were not defending the weak, but they were abusing them. And so the leaders here, Micah says, you hate the good and you love the evil. He even talks about them as cannibals. Now, they weren't physically cannibals here, but it's a picture of saying, look at how you are taking advantage of these people. You're just eating them up in all your unrighteousness. He says in chapter 3, is it not for you, leaders, to know justice, you who hate the good and love the evil? So this was what was happening here in this time. And so in chapter 5, he gets to verse 1 and he says, muster your troops, Judah. Muster your troops, O daughter of troops. In other words, you have a few people left who can fight. But guess what's going to happen? With a rod, they strike the judge of Israel on the cheek. That is the ultimate act of humiliation, to strike the king or the ruler on the cheek. In other words, no one can defend him. No one can defend anyone here. And here it's saying, get ready, you will be humiliated. You know, sometimes it's humbling to have kids point out how we're wrong. God uses the weak and the small for his glory. Psalm 8 talks of, out of the mouths of babes and infants, you have ordained praise. Well, Gideon, he used Gideon, the smallest, the weakest. Why did he do that? So they would not boast. The Bible says, so that you don't boast, it was by our hand that we did this. But instead, that they would boast in the Lord. It's only by the Lord's power that they could do this. But God doesn't leave us bare here. Calvin talks about God gives threatenings, but he also gives promises. And he mixes in threatenings with promises. We see this all throughout Micah. He says it's necessary to connect threatenings with promises so that we may be always ready to endure temporal evils, and that our minds, sustained by hope, may at the same time depend on the Lord. So if it's all judgment, we could get to the point where we just don't have anything to hope in anymore. But yet we're reminded, and that's where the word but in verse 2 comes in. But you, here's the hope. O Bethlehem, you're too little to be among the clans of Judah. From you shall come forth for me one who is to be ruler in Israel. So secondly, why does God use the small and insignificant? To show his glory. Glory shines in unlikely places and seemingly impossible things. Look at verse 2. He says, from you shall come forth for me. From you shall come forth for me. In other words, this ruler serves God. It's for God that this happens. The purpose, his purpose and design will stand, he says in that same verse, whose origin is from of old. One person says the Hebrew way of saying this was just saying from really long ago. And let's be careful not to read too much into it. Some people, well, were they thinking that Jesus was before the creation of the world? John 1:1, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was God, and the Word was with God in the beginning. The ruler here, the point is that it was planned from long ago. It wasn't just an afterthought. Oh, I think I'll bring my ruler from Bethlehem. No, there was a plan here. It also glorifies the Lord because there's power. Verse 4, and he shall stand and shepherd his flock in the strength of the Lord. The word stand there means to persevere, to endure, that he will last. Think of the time. Kings in Jerusalem, they would raise up and then a few years later they would fall. Then another one, raise up, fall, raise up, fall. This is the pattern that God's people were used to. But here in the prophecy it says he will last. He will last forever. And then we have the word shepherd. God could have chosen a different word. He could have said, and he will stand and rule his flock. But he chose shepherd. The picture of tenderness, Isaiah 40, says he will gather his lambs in his arms. He will lead them like those who are with young. Jesus Christ will be our shepherd. He is our shepherd. And how will he do this? In the strength of the Lord. Not in military might, but in the strength of the Lord. That means here, I did some cross-referencing. Well, what does it mean to shepherd in the strength of the Lord? You know what the verse said? It talked all about the fear of the Lord. So the strength of the Lord is the fear of the Lord. Isaiah 11 says, he shall not judge by what his eyes see. That's what the rulers were doing. Or decide disputes by what his ears hear. But with righteousness he will judge the poor and decide with equity for the meek of the earth. This shepherd, Jesus Christ, is coming with righteousness. This is how he will shepherd. And finally, the majesty of his name, the end of verse 4, and the Lord his God. His name is great to the ends of the earth. All nations will come to know him. Why else would God use the weak and the small? Thirdly, to strengthen our faith. To strengthen our faith. Verse 4, and they shall dwell secure. And the beginning of verse 5, and he shall be their peace. There's security and peace for us. When we have a king, a shepherd, who is shepherding in the strength of the Lord, he's with righteousness, we know we will all be treated fairly. There won't be any injustice anymore among the poor and the rich. Secondly, we will have peace. He will shepherd forever. It's not going to be another army coming and winning over and taking the king, bringing us into exile. Strengthens our faith. It creates a dependency on the Lord. You know, the great thing about this is that we're no longer dependent on ourselves. We don't have to think, well, I've got to build up a big military might. I've got to do great things here. I've got to be noticed so that God will approve of me, so that he'll be with me. It has nothing to do with us. He works through our weakness. The Bible tells us God chose what is foolish to shame the wise. He chose what is weak to shame the strong. He chose what is low and despised to bring to nothing things that are. 1 Corinthians 1. And seeing God work through the weak and the small strengthens our faith. Look at what a great God He is. Look what He can do. Some of you may have seen this movie. It's called Letters to God. And it's about a boy. It's based on a true story from what I know. A boy named Tyler who grew up in Florida. And he got word that he had cancer. And he went through treatments for the cancer. And he was trying to come to grips with the fact that he had cancer. His family too. His father had died in a car accident. So it was just his mother, Tyler, and his older brother. And Tyler began to write letters to God. It was his way of trying to communicate and work these things out to God. And so he would write these letters and he'd stick them in the mailbox. And in this kid's handwriting, it would just say, "To God." There's no other address. And he'd put a regular stamp on it. And this really confounded the people at the post office. What in the world are we supposed to do with these letters? And the man would pick up the letters and bring them back. And there'd be this stack of letters. And they're like, "Well, what should we do with these?" "Well, I don't know. You're the mail carrier for his house. You decide what to do with them." Well, the mail carrier was not a believer. He actually had a very broken life. And he just kept these stack of letters. He tried to drop them off at a church. And the pastor said, "No, I think you should deal with these." So this man, this mailman, one day he was really struggling and he thought, "Well, what should I do?" And he opened up the letters and he started reading them. And in those letters, this little boy was asking for prayer for his mailman. And the mailman was just reading it thinking, "I can't believe this." And through this, the mailman became a believer. But he also read of all these other people that the boy was talking about. "Please take care of my mom when I die. Please take care of my brother and the neighbor down the street." And all these people that this kid had built relationships with. And so the mailman began, when Tyler became very sick and he was about to die, he began delivering these letters to the people that were mentioned in the letters. And I'll tell you, it strengthened many people's faith. And he did end up dying. But it was an amazing story of how God uses the weak and the small for greatness, even to bring people to Himself. And we see that is what Christmas is about. God uses the weak. Jesus came, humbled Himself as a little baby, and was born in this little insignificant city. And beyond that, there was no room in the inn, right? Even that was too significant. He had to be born, and some people say that the manger, the stable, was a cave. It was like a hole in the side of the rock. This was where He was born, a little baby who was to be ruler for His people. And so we are humbled, aren't we, that God would send Jesus for people such as us, people who are, like Micah talks about, selfish, unrighteous, thinking about ourselves, wise in our own eyes, loving the evil, hating the good. This is who Jesus came for. And God is glorified in this. Bethlehem is great in God's eyes. And now, actually, in the world's eyes, Bethlehem is great too, right? The Church of the Nativity is built over the place where they think that Jesus was born, and people go there every year. Well, do you know what the word Bethlehem means? Bet-lechem in the Hebrew? It means house of bread. And God placed the ruler, the Messiah, in this city called the house of bread, and Jesus says, "I am the bread of life." The bread of life came from the house of bread. God's plan from ages ago. And through this, our faith is strengthened because we see his grace. Only God could do this with a small, little, tiny, insignificant place. That he is faithful despite us. He uses our weakness. And we have security and peace in him. So if you're sitting here this morning and you think, "I'm really not that significant," God would say, "That's about right." If you think you're small, or that you're not really much in the world's eyes, it doesn't matter what the world's eyes are seeing. It's what God's eyes, how God looks at you. And because of Christ, you are significant. Well, what about Trinity Presbyterian Church? I thought it was great, Cassie mentioned earlier. She's like, "You know, we have a small church." And I was like, "Yes, perfect." And that's not to say we don't want to grow, that we don't want to reach people, because we do. But the fact that we are small in the world's eyes, God loves the small. He displays his glory through here. And I just have to share one thing with you in closing. I was on the phone a while back, and I think I shared this with some of you. Mission to the World, who is of the PCA's missional agency, which we support missionaries from, called up and said, "We just want to know how we can support you, how things are going in your church, how we can support you and encourage you in missions. Can you tell us what's going on?" And so I was telling them, "Well, last year we weren't supporting any missionaries, but now we're supporting 5 missionaries, and we've had a couple of them visit the church, and one of our members is thinking about going." I think that was the time that Julie was actually in Uganda at that time. She's thinking about becoming a full-time missionary, and got a friend in Bangladesh. He's hoping to come, and we're having a Presbytery Missions Conference next week or a couple weeks away. And, you know, we're getting excited about what God is doing all over the world. And it was almost as the person on the other end did not know what to say. She said, "Wow, how big is your church?" "Oh, we're about 50 people." "Really?" She said, "It is so encouraging to hear all of what God is doing through you guys and through your presbytery that's small." And she said, "I just want to encourage you that we're going through," she said, we're going through as a group through this devotional, through the Old Testament. We're just seeing how God works through little things, how God works through small places." She said, "I just want to encourage you that God does great things in little places." So be encouraged. Don't look at how small or big, because God delights to use the small for his glory, and the weak, the despised, the things that in the world's eyes seem like nothing, but in God's eyes are great.